Welcome to The Gauge, a podcast brought to you by Green Gauge, the digital finance pioneer and first fully integrated financial services group, bridging the traditional financial services space with the new digital innovations in crypto assets and blockchain. In this series, we gauge expert opinion on the latest tech trends and plan to bring you a measured approach to discussing key developments in the world of blockchain and digital assets. In this episode, host Sean Kiernan welcomes Itay Tuchman, founder of Tomorrow Next and former global head of FX at Citi. They delve into the question of what money really is, particularly in the context of digital assets and cryptocurrencies. Itay emphasizes the practical use of money as a medium of exchange and payment system, highlighting its role in purchasing goods and services, storing value, and buying financial assets.
Welcome to another episode of The Gauge. Delighted to have Itay Tuchman with us here today. Itay has a storied background. Historically, he was global head of FX at Citi. He's now the founder of Tomorrow Next, Watch This Space, and a senior advisor at Cancelo. Itay, delighted to have you with us.
I'm more delighted to be here, Sean.
Today, we're going to be having what constitutes a globally systemic conversation to the extent we have those on the gauge. And I have an initial question to you just on what is money? I know you've been dealing with FX in a very big institutional capacity, and now in the digital space. I'd be curious for your insights.
Sure, and I won't give you the stock economist response, even though sort of my background is in economics. And I think a lot of the philosophy on what is money is better reserved for dinner conversation over a few glasses of wine. But practically, I think the debate here is around, you know, mainly the use of money as a medium of exchange, to use that term. And we can talk a lot about, you know, store of value and all these other concepts. But really, when we talk about money, particularly in the technology sphere, in the sphere of the either fintech or digital assets or crypto, we're really talking mainly about, you know, money as a payment system, an ability for people to send it for goods and services, to store it, to buy securities or other financial assets. It's really this use as an intermediate technology. And I also remind people in this debate, remember, in prison, cigarettes are money. You know, so money is really determined by, you know, human beings. It's a social construct. And of course, our societies have become very complicated. So our money has become very complicated. But to rewind a second, you know, to sort of unpack what is money in the current system, and then I'm sure Sean will talk about what money can be or maybe even should be. We might enter into that dangerous territory of what should be money. In our current system, there's really, I say, sort of three layers of money that I think a lot of people dismiss. You know, the first layer of money in our current system is central bank money. And for most people, that's notes and coins. That's central bank money for most people. If you're a bank, you're trying to avoid notes and coins these days. It's quite a burden. You know, central bank money is your account, either at the Fed or at the Bank of England or your national central bank. You know, and that's kind of core money. Other than the notes and coins that we use, and we can talk about digital cash later, digital money for you know, human beings or for end users or for companies or for individuals, you really talk about the next layer of the monetary onion. You know, in economist terms, you might talk about M1 or M2. But for all of us, that's our ledger entry at our bank or at our e-money provider. That's what we think of as individuals, as money. And that interplay between those two types of money, often kind of inside money and outside money, that's really at the heart of the technological disruption that I think we're going to see and really where money should go. So to me, that's the debate that hopefully we'll have in this globally systemic conversation, because our decision making, both as public policy, but also as human society and human beings around that, is systemic. You know, the nature of this monetary onion goes to the heart of what systemic risk is, what too big to fail is, how all of these things that we've built over many decades are constructed and maybe deconstructed.
I'd love to dig into too big to fail a bit. I know we've had a few discussions around the banks that are deemed too big to fail and the role that they play in the economy. It would be great to hear, having worked at one of the too big to fail banks, one of the things you're doing now with Tomorrow Next is addressing perhaps some of the gaps in that market. Could you elaborate on that?
Sure. You know, let's talk about too big to fail and where it comes from. You know, our system is too big to fail. You know, that's where this comes from. We have a very complex, you know, high velocity, financialized economy, which is, you know, truly global, despite all the anti-globalization debate, which is truly global. So we start with that our system is too big to fail. That if we have a failure in money, if people no longer trust both the money itself and the system it moves on and it's the places it's stored, then really our economy fails. And so the idea of having financial institutions and banks too big to fail is actually not a new concept. It's not a post-GFC concept. Deposit insurance was invented, you know, in the bank runs of the early 20th century. But the modern construct of too big to fail is also because these institutions have become so large and so globally interconnected. And ultimately, modern banking is a leveraged business. You know, a friend of mine once gave me this anecdote, which is if you think of a bank in your mind's eye, I'm talking about a physical bank, and you walk in and there's, you know, granite blocks and there's beautiful wood and this, you know, polished gold and silver everywhere, and it looks very elegant and whatever. I said, well, you know, why is that? You know, it's like, it's to give you the illusion that there's money there, right? The bank actually doesn't hold your deposits. Everyone knows we have a fractional reserve system. And the fractional reserve system in a very large, interconnected global economy leads to these very large institutions that are, you know, reasonably levered, a lot less levered than they were pre the financial crisis, to be fair, and leaves them vulnerable. They're vulnerable to sort of like disruptions, issues with money, whether those disruptions are the GFC or COVID, where we had in the system enormous moves in asset prices, huge margin calls, huge collateral shortages. You know, that's also too big to fail. But again, if you sort of bring that monetary onion back, why are we in this position? We're in this position because all of us leave our deposits at banks. That's where we use to store our sort of monetary value largely in the realm of, you know, medium of exchange. Most leave deposits at banks, not because banks pay the most amazing return. Often it's a 0% deposit, so banks are actually paying far below other market rates or safe rates of interest. So you have this tension. People are leaving deposits at banks, which are inherently risky because they are levered. They are getting, generally speaking, a below, you know, market level return, but they have to in order to be able to unlock the usefulness of money. The convenience factor of money, this bit around paying and receiving. My salary comes in, I pay my credit card bill, I pay my gas and electric bill, I pay my kids their pocket money. This is a convenience form of money that forces us onto the banking system and leads to banks being predominantly where we store very large deposits. And then you have the social tension of too big to fail. So when that happens, remember, banks are for-profit institutions. These are institutions, you know, that are, you know, capitalist at their nature. Yet there's a social guarantee. And you often hear this phrase, we're socializing the losses but privatizing the gains. The reason for that is, in my opinion, an evolution of the technology of how we move money. It is the payment system that banks are inherent to, participate in, control, this onion layer where banks access central bank money and then print through fractional reserves the money that we all use. That's at the heart of too big to fail. Of course, there are other things in the scope and nature of derivative activity and other interconnectedness that comes on top of that. But really fundamentally, this is a technology evolution. We evolved a monetary technology which put banks at the heart of payments. By doing so, we have this system that I think socially there's rightful discomfort with. And now we have a lot of technologies that may disrupt that system. And we should really think about, can we construct a system that is safe or safer than the current system, giving banks a role, because banks can and should still play a role, but at least reduce either the likelihood or the magnitude of too big to fail. I think that would be a socially positive outcome.
Going then into the progression of money, and your definition I think is very interesting. If we have the idea of banks as a payments vehicle and the reason people leave money in them as a form of convenience, we've seen the advent of e-money and firms like Revolut, who don't have full banking licenses in the UK, playing a bit of that role. And we also now have innovation in the digital space where money can be moved in the likes of stablecoins or peer-to-peer. One discussion you and I have had is on what is money in the terms of, can a deposit actually be deemed money? Can something that is digitized, that is yield-bearing, and can that move? I'd love to hear kind of, that's a big question.
Sure. Well, let's try to simplify that, because I think, Sean, that there's a lot of complexity to the question you're asking, a lot of things that are still evolving. But let's start with stablecoins. And I like to remind everyone that the first stablecoin was invented in 1971. It's known as a money market fund, right? The reserve fund was invented in the US because banks were prohibited from paying interest on demand deposits. That was the rule. If you left your money at a bank for convenience, you got 0% interest. There were other things. You could buy a CD or something else, and they were capped. And interest rates were like 8% to 9% at the time. So rightfully, someone came up with this beautiful stablecoin idea called the money market fund. And I'll talk about some other monetary forms because they all come with an Achilles heel or two. In the case of the money market fund, we have had very rare instances where money market funds have broken the buck, right? Where they are not stable. They depeg in the language of, you know, sort of, let's just say, crypto money, stable coins. But it's very rare. And it's primarily because they were not in short-dated government paper. They were in, you know, in the case of the GFC, all sorts of structured paper that really wasn't creditworthy, or they took duration, which happened, you know, decades before. But a money market fund that's solely in short-term government paper doesn't break the buck or the pound or whatever. So then its Achilles heel becomes that it's a security. It moves on the rails that securities move or funds move. And those rails aren't really suitable for payments. You know, it's very hard to send a stock from your brokerage account to another person to pay for a coffee. So you have this form factor of money, which is a money market fund. And now you're seeing, and we're involved with things like tokenized money market funds, to try to deal with that Achilles heel, to put it on a more suitable rail to allow it to move. And if money market funds can move, then you have what is essentially a risk-free, or almost risk-free, or essentially risk-free, interest-bearing, and when I say interest-bearing, almost fully entitled risk-free interest-bearing, movable money. And in the language of M1, M2, you know, these money market funds are, they're in M2. They're a kind of money. Then let's go to e-money. And current versions of, let's just say, non-interest-bearing stable coins, things like what you get from Tether or Circle, they're essentially e-money regulated. So they're e-money on blockchains. And the blockchain piece adds features, composability, decentralization, all these great things, and we can talk about those. But e-money has a really significant Achilles heel. And that is, by law, it can't pay interest. When interest rates are zero, that Achilles heel is pretty irrelevant. Now interest rates in developed economies are north of 5%. It's meaningful. And so whilst that's a very profitable business for e-money issuers, and you can look at the profits that Tether makes, for example, as an example, for users, it's a costly form factor for money. Sure, e-money regulations could get updated, things could change, but then what's the difference between a bank and an e-money provider, and do e-money providers then become too big to fail? There are all these considerations. So e-money is very seamless. Stablecoins on blockchain rails are very composable. DeFi, all of that is unlocked via tokenized e-money or stablecoins, but they don't natively pay interest because they're not allowed to. And there's a whole bunch of financial engineering trying to get at the heart of that. But fundamentally, if you do, you're not e-money. You're going to end up evolving more into that kind of tokenized money market fund format. You know, the third factor is this tokenized bank deposit thesis, which is, why don't we just take the current system and add some blockchains to it? Personally, I'm a little bit more skeptical, because what have we really given people? Have we given them some composability? Sure. Have we changed the nature that there's an inherent cost to this too big to fail that permeates not only the individual or the user, because you're not getting a government risk-free rate of interest, you're getting below a risk-free rate of interest for a risky deposit? But surely we can figure out a method that, as we're updating these form factors of money, that can deal with that Achilles heel, which is bank money is generally underpays the risk-free rate of interest and is risky. And, you know, you can ask any number of folks, even the folks who had money at Silicon Valley Bank this year, what that means. It means a government bailout, but it still meant over a weekend, payrolls couldn't be made. There was a whole lot of folks under a lot of stress thinking that they wouldn't get their deposits back. And ultimately, we had to socialize that loss in the U.S. via government guarantee. So these form factors are going to compete in the new technology, which I think, you know, decentralized and blockchain networks provide. But I like to rewind to this concept of, what is it actually that the users want? They want interest-bearing, very, very composable, seamlessly payable, cheap to move, cheap to receive, no more wire fee, which I paid this morning, by the way. I sent myself a wire from me to me. It cost me $18.75. You know, that's not what consumers want. And I think we finally have some technology that may enable that. And I'm sure we'll talk about CBDCs as kind of the last frontier at some point too, Sean.
Of course. And this could sit away from the banks, this idea of moving money around tokenized money market funds, tokenized deposits would be through the banks, but it doesn't have to be within the too big to fail banking system.
I mean, I don't see a reason why it has to be. Of course, that puts some fear into policymakers, particularly central bankers, because, you know, there's this disconnect. And I think we should be explicit about what it is. For customers of a bank, generally speaking, and you can say for you and me, or you can even say for small businesses or large businesses, banks are a convenience business. Hey, I need to make these payments. I'm going to get a bank account. For policymakers, banks are involved in this large construction of capital formation and lending, some of which is true and some of which is increasingly less true. So you have this disconnect. The users of the bank are there to make payments, and they're the ones paying the cost and the subsidy of not getting their interest and float and fees and all these things. And to policymakers, those cheap deposits are what fuels a fractional reserve monetary system that makes loans. So the worry is, okay, if we take this all out of the bank, we will have a credit crunch. Yeah, if we do that in one day, we will have a very severe credit crunch. If we are thoughtful about a monetary system where banks still have a role, but their role is no longer enshrined because they're too big to fail and have a strategic sort of a free lunch in a way. And if you talk to people who work at banks, they'll tell you it's not free. They pay enormous capital costs and regulatory costs and all these kinds of things. It's far from free. We can re-arch a system over time that gives consumers what they want, which is to remove the idea of captivation of payments from an incumbent banking system, but still provides sort of the policy sphere with a stable economy, with areas that we can actually allow for capital formation and seamless lending. There are a lot of people who look at private credit. I mean, non-bank lending is enormous, you know, and so far hasn't really proved that systemic. So I think there's a lot of ways that we can be thoughtful about re-architecting this monetary onion where banks are no longer a semi-monopoly in the realm of payments. Now, what is that going to do to bank equity? I mean, that's a different question, but I don't think, you know, policymakers should be in the business of protecting the profitability of any business. Let's make a system that's safe and stable and that works for consumers and works for businesses and encourages economic growth. And if it means a tech company does better and a financial services company does worse, so be it.
I'm going to pivot the discussion slightly to talk about the cost of money. One thing that I was fascinated, and you kind of raised this to my attention, is that the governments themselves have a higher cost of funding than the banks. When you think about these passive depositors that are just leaving money from a retail consumer base at the bank, they're not getting any interest. Whereas if a gilt or treasury is purchased, they're paying a bit more. I'd be intrigued to hear your views on that and also how you think that direction of travel might be as increasingly consumers might have more choice.
Sure. And I think it's related to the previous question, Sean. The system of fractional reserve banking is sort of forcing low interest or zero interest deposits in the banking system. Of course, costs consumers because they're not getting the interest they're entitled. I would say they're entitled to or could be entitled to, maybe is the word I would use, or could achieve. Adds friction and fees on top of that. But I think there's another sort of subtle and hard to unpack. And I don't think many people talk about this cost. And the cost is to sort of like the general society through where the risk-free interest rate is. So again, banks have a blended funding cost. Of course, it's not just deposits. They issue bonds. Those tend to trade at a spread over the risk-free rate. But let's just think of a very stylized example of a bank that just raises deposits at zero interest. And the UK government borrowing at 5%. Now, banks are riskier than the government. So there's an incongruity there from a risk perspective. It only makes sense because consumers are forced to use banks for payments. So we deposit money there and they don't have to pay an interest rate to get that funding. Why are government interest rates at 5% to begin with? Let's ask that question. And that's set, generally speaking, by the central bank. It's set to balance growth and inflation dynamics in an economy, generally to serve an inflation mandate. And classic economic theories, the higher the interest rate the central bank sets, the more it's sort of clamping down on credit, a higher funding rate, slowing the economy. But because banks are the conduit of credit creation, as we were talking about, this idea that policymakers, that banks take these low interest deposits and make loans, you know, that 0% subsidy allows banks to make loans, let's say, and I'm just inventing here, 7%. So the government borrows money at 5%. Banks borrow money at 0% to make loans in the private sector at 7%. But the government sets that 5% to get to that 7%. If you had a system where banks had to pay a market rate or a spread over, if banks had to fully fund their lending, let's just say via bond issuance, and no demand deposits, there's no convenient form factor 0% deposit base. I got to borrow, like private credit funds do. They borrow from LPs and they lend at a spread over that. And that was the entire economy, the credit cycle of the economy. Well, to get to 7% as that borrowing rate that balances growth and inflation, the risk-free rate would be much lower. You know, risk-free rate might be 2%. and a bank might be borrowing at 4% and then making loans to other people at 7%. And that difference, we all pay as taxpayers. We all pay because the government has less money for goods and services into the public sector. And so there's this cost to society of the fractional reserve system, because particularly at times of high inflation like now, the risk-free rate has to be higher than it otherwise would be under a fractional reserve system. And I think a lot of people miss that when they think of, oh, we can't go to a system that's less dependent on bank deposits as the like sort of funding mechanism for monetary creation, because it would collapse credit. Credit would be so expensive. No, it's going to be just as expensive as it is now. It's just about who pays that cost, where does it go versus where it goes now. Now banks get a subsidy in a system which is less dependent on fractional reserve sort of lending. That subsidy is lower. And the returns of that accrue to either customers, consumers, businesses, the government, public sector. And I think it's very relevant when we get to CBDCs, because this is part of that whole debate.
It's interesting to look back as well before central banks and the way that the historic merchant banks operated. They kind of were the Apollos of their day. Shadow banking was the way of banking in a sense. And what I find interesting is that shadow banking itself sounds nebulous and a bit scary. And I know regulators are often less keen on, as you mentioned, the potential systemic risk that a non-banking source of lending could open up. What I haven't understood is, obviously, if it became systemic is one thing, but as a construct, say it's a new onion or a slightly differently shaped onion, if you have less of a too-big-to-fail actor in that and you have more disparate actors, I can't get my head around how that is worse.
Well, I mean, let's talk about free banking maybe as a good example, because free banking is a lot of debate, particularly in the digital asset community and, you know, what's true and what's not true. But part of what made free banking challenging in the places that it really didn't work very well, and in the US, you had plenty of bank panics as a result of that. One of the reasons is you didn't know anything or very much about the bank that's issuing your money. You were in Kentucky, you got this bank note from a bank in New York that somebody gave you in exchange for your cows or your horses or whatever. You had no clue about what that bank is, what they're doing, how creditworthy they are. I mean, what you heard, they would trade at a discount. So the information asymmetry caused money to trade non-fungibly. But, you know, this is even pre-telegraph, or almost pre-telegraph, right? We're in a different universe of technology. And if we can't use technology and our advancement in data and understanding and transparency and all these sorts of things to ameliorate some of those effects, there's not much we can do as human beings. So now we're in an era where we can actually, and again, I'm advocating for a system which is regulated. This is not, let's go to a complete Wild West unregulated system. Let's just update the way we think about what a regulated system looks like. Now we're in an environment where we can know the inner workings of a credit book at a bank. Yeah, I'm not saying with certainty, but with a lot more transparency. I mean, that's what bank examiners and regulators do in almost every important bank in the world every day. So we're in a different universe of data. And so we can think about concepts like non-bank lending or and again, shadow banking is like cryptocurrency. You know, we invent this word and it has these connotations maybe that aren't intended. But you have a system where, you know, you can regulate and do regulate that system, and you can be much more crisp about what's actually going on, the creditworthiness. It doesn't require fractionalization, right? So it's, you know, a private credit fund can't create money. So they take in $1 billion of LP, you know, investment, they make $1 billion of loans, right? So you don't have this highly levered stack there, because you can't invent money. Only banks can sort of do that. And so over time, and maybe a long period of time, if we sort of deflate that fractional reserve system, we don't necessarily, by definition, just go back to a Wild West 19th century financial system, because what we can know, understand, evaluate, measure, show transparently, prove, and again, there's a lot of developments in the blockchain and digital asset space that may come to bear here, changes the nature of the risks that we can measure, evaluate, and control. And so I'm one of these people who thinks if you go back to the, you know, 19th century to just look at how things worked and put it on the 21st century, I just think it's a real mistake.
And you see this gradual transition happening already to a certain extent. But banks are debanking and de-lending, and the credit funds didn't really exist kind of 20 years ago to the extent that they do today. This is a massive growth of a different source of capital. And it's intriguing to hear, as you say, that if you didn't have that fractional reserve system, the overall cost of capital in the system might not increase. I'd love to finally unpack the last layer of the onion, CBDCs, which, as you mentioned already, stablecoins by definition cannot be yield bearing, and we saw the profits of Circle, for example, being very healthy because of the amount of money that they're generating on those returns that they can keep in the company. A CBDC is obviously not a yield bearing instrument either yet, as currently thought through. But I'd love to hear how you're approaching this.
Yeah, CBDCs, and I've used some off-color language before. You know, I'm not convinced CBDCs is anything but a solution looking for the problem. There's a healthy debate on that. But let me just start by saying that I think we should think of CBDCs more of a payment network than as a money. You know, now cash is a payment network. You say, what do you mean it's a payment network? Yeah, it uses the laws of physics as the payment network. You know, I see you, Sean, we split a coffee. I happen to have a couple of quid in my pocket. Well, coffee's more expensive to see. I have a fiver in my pocket and I give it to you for my coffee. That's a payment network. It's a bearer physical payment network. And what guarantees that payment network is the certainty of the coinage and mintage, the certainty of the note, the little strip which says this is real. That's the payment network. So the move to, let's start with the retail CBDC, because I think it's the hardest one to really get your head around support or there's a lot of fear in that. It's to sort of update that central bank payment network under this view that cash is disappearing, people don't want cash, but we still need to have a central bank issued cash. And I'm not really sure why. People are getting rid of cash because they want to go to a digital form of money. It's not like, oh, I want to go to a digital form of money, but I really need this to be central bank money. Like, I don't see many coffee buyers saying that. I think the challenge is, and one of the things, and I don't believe this is the thrust of CBDC amongst policymakers, but there's something there. If you look at notes and coins, and I know we talk a lot about monetary debasement, lots of people talk about it, high inflation, all everything that's going on, QEs, et cetera, et cetera. You know, monetary debasement is really where the government is getting a subsidy by printing more money and not paying for that, right? And they've done so for, I was going to say centuries, but it's actually millennia that's been happening. So it's not a new concept. It's not, there's nothing immoral. It's just a standard form of government and governments who run debts and deficits. You know, there is a history of that. But if there are no notes and coins, let's say today that the system just has no notes and coins and it's all bank deposits, forget everything else. Well, those bank deposits pay interest. They might not pay me interest or you interest, Sean, but they pay the bank interest. So there's no debasement there. There's no free lunch. And we have highly indebted societies. If you look at notes and coins as a share of money in circulation, like in the US, I think notes and coins, and it might be correct, to be honest, 2 to 3 trillion. And a lot of that circulates outside of the US, and we don't need to ask why, on a monetary base of 30 plus. Right? So it's a very small share and a shrinking share. And in places like Northern Europe, almost a zero share. So there's one aspect of CBDC, which is we still want this ability to have central bank issued money or government issued money or inside money in the hands of consumers. And it's not because I'm saying there's an argument because we want to debase it, but it's because it's part of the system that we've lived with for a long, long time to have these notes and coins in a system of financial stress, for example. And this is one maybe good reason to have notes and coins. If the internet goes down, we want to still be able to buy food. And this is like a scary dystopian concept, but payment systems do go down for an hour sometimes or whatever sometimes. So there's this fallback of central bank money, and CBDC may be that. Now, CBDC may also be an ability to use technology to unlock a features of money that are really difficult or impossible to unlock now, but may serve up. And again, this is a matter of political debate or social opinion purpose. Again, I'm not being judgmental about this, but when money is fungible, when your bank account and my bank account are the same, but this means, let's say we decide to create stimulative money, well, then that money is the same. I think first it's a fiction that people think that that's entirely true today, but it's not entirely true today because certain forms of money are sanctioned. They're different. They are not permitted to be the same as the money from that you and I possess. You see what happened with the war in Ukraine and the monetary reserves of the Central Bank of Russia. So we're already starting to create, and again, this doesn't really affect 99.99% of people, a system where money is no longer perfectly fungible. CBDC is a technology, or could use a technology, that really makes a quantum leap in that. Let's just say we want a stimulus, but we only want people to use it for food. That seems like a very laudable social aim. Let's say we had a real, some real event, and we wanted to make sure that people could eat, but not take advantage of the government, or buy luxury cars or whatever. Well, a payment system like CBDC could be built to do that. And so by sort of making this path and bringing government into the payment system, in a way, it unlocks those possibilities. And then the last thing I'll say, which I think is interesting, which is, let's say none of those objectives are supported or part of the system. We have a kind of good outcome. I call that a good outcome, where we're just talking about a cash replacement central bank payment network for things like small transactions and frictionless, and it's super good, and it's interoperable, and it has some international linkages, so FX is cheaper, and people are really, they like it. Bank of England, you know, e-money, like PayPal, Square, what? Oh, great, this is terrific. Consumers start to adopt it. Well, that subsidy that banks are collecting from that 0% demand deposit, guess who gets to collect that now? You know, the federal governments get to collect that. And again, I'm not saying what's better or worse, but it's possible. It's possible that CBDC will re-architect this banking system, this onion we talked about, because it'll just be more attractive for us to leave money with the federal government in their payment network than it is to leave with our high street bank. I mean, if we get the same interest, but one is safer than another, one's payments are cheaper than another, one's customer service is easier, or it's more composable. Think of what they've done in India. Think of what they've done in Brazil with Pix. People love it. It's really taking off. So CBDC, I think of as a payment system more than I think of as a monetary system. And a really good retail CBDC system may prove problematic for banks because consumers may prefer it. I'll make my last comment about wholesale CBDC, because there's this whole other bit around CBDC for settlement of trades between banks. It's a good idea. The reality is we're just updating that middle, that central part of the onion from a system that closes, that goes down, that isn't particularly composed. I mean, what is SWIFT? People don't know. SWIFT is what is essentially, you know, standard format WhatsApp message. You know, we can do better. And so, and things like security settlement times and all these things that add costs that maybe the consumer doesn't see or the user doesn't see, but they're embedded in your financial services, those costs can go down. And again, banks will be happy with that too, because they also bear those costs. So I think something like updating a wholesale CBDC, wholesale ledger, or this, how does that most inside central bank money, even in the current system, the current onion, the current fractional reserve system, I mean, it's a good idea. And I think it's going to happen in one shape or another in a lot of geographies.
I found this very rich. I have one final question, if I may.
Sure.
You've covered a lot of ground, and I've been fascinated to think about this idea of the current payments infrastructure almost as a tax on the consumer, these frictional costs being worn by them, not just through the immediate cost of moving money, but also through the additional cost of funding for the state itself by not having that freedom to raise at a level that's commensurate with the banks. If we look at the challenge, which is often raised, of credit creation, then that other side of the balance sheet, not just paying yield on a bit of money, but trying to support the creation of further monies available for growth in business. If the state were to remove the cost or reduce the cost of servicing debt, which I know now in the UK at least is higher than the total defense budget that we're covering interest payments, do you think there's some way the state would or should get involved in the credit creation? Or is that best left, do you still think, with proper underwriting and commercial actors?
I mean, I'm sort of capitalist by nature, and I generally think the state has a role to play in lots of things, but being the primary provider of credit in the economy is probably not a good one. And I think if you talk to most politicians, they would agree with that. You know, there are instances where the state gets very marginally involved. You know, they want to encourage a particular industry, you know, and there's a spectrum, and you can get to places where there are state-owned industries. So I generally take the political side of it's best if the private sector finds a solution. There are occasions where maybe that's not true, but generally speaking. But I do think that the payment system, because the payment system is really as it is because the state is in the middle of it. The central bank is in the middle of this onion, right? So all of these, the regulatory environment is in the middle, is something that we should think about in terms of the costs, as you mentioned. And let's just be explicit about what those costs are. And this is a McKinsey number, so I didn't invent this number. Please complain to them if you think it's grossly under or over. $2 trillion per annum of costs that we all pay for what is essentially payments messaging and all the different parts of the daisy chain it's required for me to send you that $5 for the coffee. And it's different in different geographies, but it just sounds like a giant number. So let's try to unpack that number. It's $1 trillion for B2B. So that's, you know, business costs. It's $1 trillion for consumers, B2C, right? That's directly consumers. If you look at it in developed economies and you kind of make some real stylized assumptions, it's thousands per person in advanced economies, thousands. I mean, that's a meaningful percentage of the average income in those places. If you look at less developed societies, whilst the numbers may be smaller, you know, nominally per person, they're super large as a percentage of the person's average income or GDP per capita. And we know that because remittance, for example, is horribly expensive. Talk to a student in the United States that comes from West Africa. I know a young man who's trying to solve this problem and how difficult it is for his family to pay his tuition and how expensive it is. Or you talk to folks that are sending money back to countries in Asia, how expensive it is for them to use remittance corridors. And the reason is because there's a lot of friction. It's not just a ripoff. It's easy for us to look at 10% of a remittance and say, whoa, that's a ripoff. But that ripoff is, you know, unpack it, it's because there are so many frictions involved in doing so, whether they're AML or KYC frictions. We don't have standard records, so everybody has to perform their own due diligence on a person in a different way every single time. There's real problems with the corridors. There's all sorts of regulations and burdens. So if we update our payments architecture thoughtfully, right, in a smart, sustainable, low-risk way, using modern technology, surely we can take some of that $2 trillion and return it into the pockets of businesses and consumers. Now, that money doesn't go into, like, we don't burn it. Other people collect it. I used to say a lot when I was in banking, you know, somebody else's cost is our revenues. But ultimately, it goes into the hands, maybe create a little bit more of an equal distribution of those costs, and we grow the economy, so we make the pie bigger. So businesses keep an extra £1,000 a year. And that's an extra person that maybe, you know, they can hire over the holidays to meet customer demand and serve more customers, and we grow the economy. So to me, this debate, it's not just about who wins and who loses. It's not just about we don't like banks, we don't want them to win, we don't like this technology, it's scary. It's about being thoughtful about using modern technology and the developments that we've had to create a better system so that we grow the pie, we make the economy grow. And I think that's also at the heart of why I see here in the UK, particularly all the positive developments from the government in digital assets. You know, we were quite actively, and I'm working quite actively at Tomorrow Next, in enabling digital forms of things that people already know and are comfortable with. And in the monetary sense, it's money market funds, and we'll continue to develop that. But the UK government has been quite positive. You have an all-party parliamentary group here that says, yes, we see this technology has the capacity to improve our financial system, and we want to be thoughtful about it as we implement changes. And I think at the heart of that is going to be payments, you know. And for those folks who listen to this podcast who, like me, came to digital assets through Bitcoin, for example, just read the first line of the Bitcoin white paper. Like, the word payments is in there. And it's because it's so central to our monetary system. Like, this idea that our monetary system, it exists to lubricate the movement of value and paying and receiving. And so this technology that was developed by some amazing people and continues to be developed by some amazing people, blockchain, decentralized networks, you know, things like zero knowledge and all these things that may get at permissioning without identity, all these wonderful and interesting technological advancements, let's purpose them for making our monetary and payment system and other systems better and unlock the growth that comes with that. And I'm really positive about what's happening here in the UK at a policy level. I think it's recognized.
Itay, this has been fascinating and a real treat. So thank you very much for your time.
Sean, seeing you is always the treat. So I thank you in return.